Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Online at andreasgift.com.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later today, from 2 until 4 o'clock, the Carthage Library, the Hedberg Library, is going to be hosting a reception in honor of my 30 years here at WGTD, and in particular, my work I have done over the last few years as the host of The Morning Show. It was the idea of several different staff members there, but chiefly Carol Sabar, that it would be interesting if the Hedberg Library were to acquire a collection of some of the books which have been featured on The Morning Show. And they have done exactly that. In fact, 150 books have been gathered together and are part of this special collection, which will be accessible to members of the community at large. And today's reception, open to the public, is an opportunity to dedicate that collection of books and to talk about how much we all love books. The interview which sort of spurred the initial idea was the interview which you're going to be hearing on today's program, an interview with writer Howard Soons about his book called 27, A History of the 27 Club Through the Lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. These very talented musicians share a very sad distinction. All of them had troubled lives and died at the untimely age of 27. But this book is not at all sensationalistic. It is a very thoughtful, perceptive look at each of these individuals and what led them each down a path of self-destructive ruin. The book is published by Da Capo Press. Here is that conversation with author Howard Soons talking about his book called 27. Can we at first talk about what has led you to be so interested in the lives of artists and especially musicians? Is that a lifelong interest? And at what point did you find yourself devoting so much of your time and energy professionally to exploring their lives?
Well, I'm primarily interested in, I guess, personalities, people who are psychologically interesting. And I've written about different types of people. I wrote a biography of Charles Bukowski, the writer. I've written about crime. I've written about sportsmen and three books about musicians. But the common denominator for me is that they're all really interesting people. And also, I try to write about people whose work I admire. And I was a great admirer of Amy Winehouse, who has this image as a sort of drunken, sort of rather foolish person, but she was a terrific songwriter, a really talented songwriter, and a tragic person. And her demise 2 years ago led me down this path of investigating the lives of other great stars who happened to have died at the same age, which has become such a phenomenon.
As I read your book, well, first of all, regarding Amy Winehouse, I realized really for the first time how harshly and unkindly I had regarded her and her story. I mean, from a musical point of view, she meant absolutely nothing to me. I mean, I'd never heard any of her songs. I wasn't interested in her as a musician in the way that, you know, not everybody's interested in every kind of music. But she did sort of fascinate me as this tragic and mostly to me very pathetic figure. And I only realized upon reading your book that I really had allowed myself to view her only as, in a sense, kind of a laughing stock or as a
as a sort of a warning to others about how not to live your life. And you, through your book, you help us see her as a human being, which in one respect is a very painful thing, because it makes her demise, in a sense, much sadder for us than if we're just viewing it from a very much an emotional distance. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if anybody else has said that about your book, that it allows us to feel pain on behalf of these figures for whom maybe we only saw them with derision before.
Yes, I mean, I think you have to care about these people, and I cared about them, writing about them, and I took them seriously and treated their lives and their deaths with respect. So they're not joke figures to me. Some are more likable than others. I personally thought that Amy was very, very talented, a very great songwriter, a tremendous singer, a true original, actually, a very original artist. And she was also a very likable person, very clever, stylish, unusual, rather brave and bold, and the drunkenness was desperately sad, and that really was a symptom of a very unhappy life. But she was nevertheless an extremely talented and singular artist, one of the greatest that have come along for many years, and her one great album, Back to Black, is absolutely knockout, 5 stars. You know, if you haven't got it, go and get it. It's absolutely wonderful, and it's a record of deep personal pain. And I hope in the book that the readers go beyond the image and they see really Amy as she was, tremendously talented young lady whose life was troubled right from the start. And that's really what the book is about. We see that all these artists had very difficult early lives, and they were in trouble before they became famous, and fame only made things more difficult because they didn't cope well with sudden success, wealth, and the pressure that comes with success.
Another general comment I want to make about your book, and I also very much appreciated this, is that you, as you've already indicated, are writing with respect and in some cases certainly with affection about these musicians. I mean, you are looking at them and looking at their lives in a rather kind way, and certainly in a fair way. And on the other hand, I feel like you do not go so far as to excuse them for their self-destructiveness. I mean, you don't entirely lay the blame at the doorstep of others who may have failed them in one way or another. I mean, I think you, at least that's the way I read this book, you really achieve a very interesting and I should think uncommon balance here in regarding them kindly and humanely, and yet at the same time not excusing them for some terribly foolish self-destructive choices which all of these people made. Can you just talk about that a moment and whether or not that was something with which you really sort of consciously wrestled, that balancing act?
Well, I think whenever you write about people, you owe it to them to be honest and fair, especially if they're dead, they can't answer back. And so much nonsense has been written about these people, so much of that is frankly untrue and ridiculous. Conspiracy theories that the mafia killed them, that they died in all sorts of, there's all sorts of bizarre explanations for how they died. There's so much dishonest journalism and dishonest books, frankly, written about these people, that I thought it was refreshing to simply set out the facts of their lives, and also to remind the readers that they were really terrifically talented people. And of course, like all of us, you know, they had frailties. Their frailties were more pronounced than most of us, and I think they were all self-destructive to a point of actually killing themselves, which is a rather bold statement. Only one of them has suicide on their death certificate, and that is Kurt Cobain, who shot himself. But actually, when you look at the trajectory of these 6 lives, they all killed themselves in the sense that they abused drink and drugs, and they abused their bodies, their health, to the point where death was very, very likely if not inevitable. And that's rather a hard thing to face up to if you're a fan of these people, because you don't like to think that your hero was so unhappy, was so mentally messed up that they wanted to die. And that, I think, is the truth of the matter. It's no accident that Amy Winehouse died. She wanted to die. And I think that the same is true of all of these people to a degree. That's really a very dark story, very challenging story. And that's the story that we build up to through the book. We start in childhood, and we see how life starts and how it goes a bit wrong, and indeed as it also goes right, because all these people get very lucky as well. They're both lucky and unlucky. But then the second part of the book, which is about their last days and death, we see this sort of common downward path. This sort of, they're all running headlong into the arms of death, with a capital D, and that's really a very shocking, common story.
Mm. We're speaking with Howard Soons about his book 27. A History of the 27 Club Through the Lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. You say this towards the very beginning of the book: the 27 Club is essentially a media construct based on a coincidence. It is also a flippant, even vulgar term. Nevertheless, the phrase is widely used and understood, and these deaths are intriguing. The question is, are there common factors apart from coincidence that help explain the death of Amy Winehouse and the five major rock stars who died before her at the age of 27? You go on from there to explore, which is kind of an intriguing matter, of whether or not there really should be something called the 27 Club, or if in fact young artists die all the time at tragically young ages, and some of them die at 27, some die at 26, 29, whatever. Tell us a little more about what you discovered as you sort of numerically explored this notion of the 27 Club.
Yeah, well, the 27 Club is indeed a sort of media invention, and it came about because a number of very big names happened to die at the same age, and over the years this became very apparent, and journalists started to write about it, and by the time that Kurt Cobain died in 1994, it was such a prevalent concept that his mother, the day he died indeed, said to a reporter, "He's gone and joined that stupid club. I told him not to." So by this stage, everybody knows that there is this notional club of rock stars who died at the same age. Now, the first thing to do, writing about this club, is to examine the facts. You know, how unusual is it to die at 27 if you're a musician? So what I did at the beginning of the book, I did a survey of over 3,000 musicians who died over a period of 100 years, and I made this into a graph, just to see what the peak age of death was and how the graph revealed the numbers. And of course, most musicians die actually in middle age, late middle age. 61 is the peak age, and the graph builds up, and then it goes down, as you would imagine, as people reach that age, they're more likely to die, and less people die in very old age because there's less of them around. But right at the start, there is this spiking in numbers at 27. There is a spike. 50 people actually died at age 27, which is quite a dramatic spike in the early part of the graph. And there's lots of reasons for that, actually. There's quite complicated reasons. But then what I did is I took those 50 people and I looked at their lives. I picked out the six most famous and compared their lives. So that was my methodology.
I wonder if you could say a word about the challenge of probing into the lives of people like this. And first of all, we're of course talking about some musicians who died a fairly long time ago. I mean, maybe died 45 years ago. And so a fair amount of time has elapsed, and probably even at the time there was enough chaos surrounding their lives that even in the moment or in the immediate aftermath of their deaths, it might have been difficult to trace certain storylines with great certainty. And even now, even when with something as recent as Amy Winehouse, I mean, to whom do you speak to whom can you trust in terms of who's going to give the clearest and most truthful account of what happened to her and why. Can you just say a kind of a general word about the challenge of writing about people living lives like this, and particularly in trying to trace their each demise?
Well, my books are all based on original research, which means to say that apart from, of course, reading everything that's been written before in books and in newspapers, I then go out and I try to speak to all the living witnesses I can get to, and I find whatever official reports there may be, autopsy reports, death certificates, police reports. And I go to the various places involved in the story, so I would go to wherever the people lived and died and try to somehow absorb the atmosphere of the place so I can write about it with some originality. So my books, 27, is like my previous books about Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan and Charles Bukowski and the books I've written about crime, in that they're based on original research, which is actually very difficult to do, by the way. It's a rather painstaking and difficult task. Not everyone wants to speak to you. Not everybody is around. You know, a lot of people are now dead, especially when you go back to the 60s. But if you persevere and you plug away, you can find friends and, you know, former lovers and bandmates and members of the family who will give you a perspective which brings a freshness to the story. Now, they don't all tell the truth. That's one of the problems you face. People lie, and they dissemble, and they cover up. And that's one of the themes in this book, that we find the 27s are often surrounded by people who frankly aren't very reliable and exploit them. And that's a real theme in the story, a very unhappy theme. And that's true of investigating their lives, that you find these people who are obstructive and dishonest and they have their own agendas. But other people are honest and frank, and you have to piece together all this evidence and not neglect the actual written evidence, i.e. the official files. If there was an autopsy, what is the coroner's report? What is the police report? What does the death certificate say? And I try to base my work on these findings rather than go off into the realm of fantasy, where with conspiracy theories and the like, of which there's been so many with these people. And some of them are really, really ridiculous. So it's all based on hard facts, as far as I can find hard facts, and it's based on original interviews. And then, of course, in my own mind, I have to work all this stuff out and come up with what I really believe to be true. So at the end of the day, it's my take on the whole thing, but it's based on original information.
Right. And just now as you were speaking, I began to put something together in my mind for the very first time. And it reminded me of something that, again, comes from early in the book when you write, throughout the story of the 27 Club, there is reluctance on the part of family members, friends, and fans to accept that such talented young people died in wretched and often banal circumstances. To suggest that they died because of their own foolishness is taken as an insult. It is even more egregious to suggest that they wanted to die. And you just mentioned the conspiracy theories that spring up. I just completed an interview about John F. Kennedy, and the 50th anniversary of his assassination is coming up, and this guest made the point that because for many people JFK is a figure straight out of Camelot, that to them it is so offensive, inconceivable, that just one troubled lone gunman could bring all that crashing to the ground, and that is what fuels the incessant, persistent conspiracy theories around JFK's assassination, the fact that that is a way for people to make sense of something so senseless. And what you're describing with some of the people who were closest to these artists is that also for them, and maybe for many of their fans, they just simply don't want to accept that people with such gifts, with such promise, could come to this kind of sad, pathetic end.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true, yeah.
Let's talk about the experience of probing into the childhood of each of these artists. You say that's one thing that they have in common, unhappy childhoods, although at one point you ultimately draw a distinction between Amy Winehouse and the other five in terms of the amount of contact with their families. But were these unhappy childhoods very much in the same way, or did that unhappiness play out in very different fashion for each of them?
Some of them just didn't get along with their parents. That's quite common. Of course, that's common with teenagers the world over, but it's quite marked with the 27s. And what is also very marked is situations where parents break up and separate, divorce, when the children are at a very impressionable age. Now, Kurt Cobain, who was perhaps one of the more articulate and intellectual of these people, actually, he very much and blamed He was very much prone to self-analysis, and he blamed his problems, his psychological problems, which were the basis of his drug problem and eventually his suicide. He blamed all that squarely on one key event in his early life, and that was when his parents separated and divorced very acrimoniously, hating each other, blaming each other, having scenes in front of the children, very upsetting domestic arguments. When he was a young boy, and this was the key turning point in his life. And actually, I was then rather amazed to find that at the exact same age this happened to Kurt Cobain, the same thing happened to Amy Winehouse. Her dad left home for a younger woman, completely selfish reasons. It wasn't an acrimonious divorce like Kurt Cobain's parents, but dad essentially abandoned the family. You know, and that leaves kids with a great feeling of, you know, was it something that I did? That's the typical response of kids whose parents break up. Is it my fault? And that leads to all sorts of problems. Jimi Hendrix's parents fought like cat and dog. Jim Morrison disliked his parents so intensely that he refused to speak to them in latter life. And when they tried to see him, come to see him at his concerts, he snubbed them. He wouldn't take their phone calls. He absolutely loathed them. Brian Jones also had a very difficult relationship with his parents, and Janis Joplin. So it's common to all of them that they had these very difficult, unhappy relationships with their parents.
What you, the distinction you draw, I believe, with Amy Winehouse is that basically with the other five, they essentially divorced themselves from their parents. I mean, had almost no contact whatsoever, or what very little contact there was strained and unhappy, but that in fact Amy Winehouse did not distance herself from her own family in quite the same way, although you also quite rightly point out that in maintaining close ties with her father, that led to some other problems.
Well, yeah, her dad became, no, you're quite right, she was close to her parents for the rest of her life. But she seemed to forgive her dad for abandoning the family. And indeed, her dad became very, very active in her life. He became a kind of manager, really, which is a rather curious aspect of her story. And I don't think her father comes out of it very well. He frankly became a little bit too busy in her career, and one wonders what his motivation was, really. I think he enjoyed, to put the matter gently, he enjoyed the limelight as much as she did, or maybe a little bit more than she did. He wanted to be a performer himself, her father, and I think he was living vicariously through her success, and he became a celebrity by association with his daughter. And when she died, as in the case of many of these people, it's the parents who end up getting rich, because, you know, he became a millionaire as a result of her death. So the family story is complicated and unhappy, actually, with all of these people. It's really not a very edifying story.
Hmm. And you tell the story of how, in so many cases, and as you've already touched on this, how artists have often found themselves surrounded by a circle of admirers and collaborators who end up being ultimately very disruptive presence in their lives. And in the case specifically of Kurt Cobain and Amy Winehouse, you say that once they had found their voices, their rise to the top was rapid, and in becoming celebrities, they took up with partners who shared their weaknesses, which exacerbated their problems. That's probably a a very common problem that often plays out far away from the spotlight and in the lives of just everyday people. But, of course, for these artists and their lives in the spotlight, it's a story that we sort of follow with interest and ultimately with horror. Tell us about these partnerships that were so ultimately damaging, particularly to these two.
Well, Amy Winehouse and Kurt Cobain did almost exactly the same thing. They both took up with fellow drug users. So Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, and Amy Winehouse and a man called Blake Fielder Civil. And indeed, they married these people. And these were people who abused drugs as they abused drugs. So these were marriages, love affairs based on the use of narcotics. And Courtney and Blake are not particularly sympathetic characters. One shouldn't blame them for what happened, but they were not strong people. Well, I think Courtney Love is a very strong person in some respects, but she's not somebody who is necessarily supportive, not somebody who was the best person to marry Kurt Cobain. I think they made each other worse. They exacerbated each other's problems. And then, of course, you know, broaden this out a little bit. Look at Jim Morrison. Now, he lived with a woman called Pamela Courson, and who was with him when he died. Now, she was a heroin user, as he was. And the reason there's been so much mystery about the death of Jim Morrison in Paris in 1971 is, quite frankly, that Pamela Courson lied to the police about what happened. And she lied to the French police about what happened because she was a heroin user and she was terrified of getting herself into trouble. And so she didn't tell them the truth. And then look at Jimi Hendrix, who died here in London. I'm speaking to you from London. He died here in 1970. Now, he died in the hotel room of a woman who's also now dead, who was a drug abuser and was also dishonest. Was just a liar. She lied about what happened to Jimmy in his last hours. And then Brian Jones also spent his last hours with somebody who is less than reliable. So this is a very common. This runs through the story that these people, you know, they are themselves psychologically weak people who are prone to bad habits, and they tend to hook up with likewise people, and that's a bad combination.
Is that also some kind of a combination that contributes to their success and to their fame, or do they achieve their fame, whatever artistic greatness they achieve, and then this happens to them? I mean, is there any way in which the characteristics you just described, which ultimately lead to their demise, are an ingredient in what propels their success?
Well, it is to a degree, because, of course, it's part of the psychodrama of their lives, which is part of the image, of course. But much more importantly, in Amy Winehouse's case, for instance, her one great album, she only made two albums. The first one is kind of so-so, but the second one, Back to Black, is the classic. Well, what is Back to Black about? It's all about her unhappy love affair, her tempestuous love affair with this man, Blake Fielder Civil, who was a drug user, the man she married. And it's all about how, you know, they are lovers, and then they break up, and she's heartbroken and bereft and wants to die. And it's all about those emotions. And, of course, so Blake is, in fact, the inspiration for this great work of art. And, indeed, look at Janis Joplin, whose work was based upon, you know, anguish and her emotional problems, often with men. Now, she wasn't a great songwriter like Amy Winehouse, but she was certainly a great singer and performer. And her performances were performances of anguish, an anguished woman like Edith Piaf and Judy Garland and so many others through history, Billie Holiday. And so the personal life informs the work, very much so, and very much so with Amy Winehouse, who was such a great songwriter. And really, if you look at the lyrics on Back to Black, she writes about the experience of an unhappy love affair with enormous insight and passion.
This reminds me of something you say at the end of chapter one of your book, in talking about the presence of adversity and pain in the lives of these particular musicians and others. You write at one point, in a sense, we should thank the parents of the 27s, inadequate as many were, for creating an environment conducive to artists. If mommy and daddy had provided happier homes, their sons and daughters might have passed in anonymity. They might still be alive, but who would have heard of the optometrist Brian Jones, assuming he had followed the career his parents envisioned? Who would have known Jimi Hendrix, landscape gardener, or care about Janis Joplin, Port Arthur housewife? Who would read the sociologist Jim Morrison or give a damn about school janitor Kurt Cobain? As for Amy Winehouse, she worked briefly as a reporter before going into show business and might have been in journalism still had her background and character been different. And at the start of that paragraph, you say history shows that artistic people are often born in adversity and thrive on pain. I guess the point is they might thrive on pain for a while, but at some point they cease to thrive and begin to destroy themselves because of that pain.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very common for creative people to have this thing that they grind their intellect against, which is some problem, some neurosis in their early life or in their life, and that's where the work comes from. But, you know, some people are stronger than others. You know, a person like Bob Dylan can go through a very unhappy marriage, for instance, and make great art out of it, the album Blood on the Tracks, one of the greatest rock albums ever made, and yet Bob Dylan lives on and he enjoys his life because he's basically is psychologically a strong character. But somebody like Amy, Brian Jones, Janis Joplin, they're not so strong. So they go through these traumatic experiences, as we all do in life. You know, we all go through bad times in life with breakups, bereavements. You know, this is not particular to rock stars. Most of us manage to get through that. But these people kind of got bogged down in those problems. You know, you get a sense that they're obsessive about their problems. Amy Winehouse's album, Back to Black, is an obsessive album. It's really a mad piece of work. And indeed, she was mad. You know, she was in and out of clinics, and her doctors pleaded with her to have psychiatric counseling because she was mentally disturbed. Brian Jones went through the same clinics 40 years earlier, you know, saw psychiatrists 40 years before. Kurt Cobain frankly admitted to having mental health problems, and the same was true of Janis Joplin. So these are people with psychological problems.
About Amy Winehouse, another point that you make that I think is interesting, and I would love to get a sense also of if this is something shared by some of the others. She gets a big break in the year 2000, and you write that success came relatively quickly and easily after this break. Amy was offered a management deal followed by a recording and publishing contracts, giving her financial freedom virtually straight from school. She was not an artist who had to work for years to get started. She did not pay her dues. To some extent, she may have been spoiled by easy early breaks. What we don't work for, we don't value. And Amy seemed to put a low value on her subsequent career, behaving in a cavalier fashion seldom found in people who have worked harder and longer for their chance to be heard. Can you say a word about just how rapid Amy Winehouse's rise was and how you think that may have ultimately influenced and contributed to her self-destructiveness?
Well, all of these people get famous around the same time, around about the age 22, 23. But in Amy's case, unlike the others, she went from school straight into a record deal and a well-paid record deal. And she didn't have to go through Jimi Hendrix, for instance, was played for years in obscurity on the road in America, played in various bands, played for Little Richard, people like that, you know, played in clubs. And before he got his break, he started to make some money. But Amy made money right from the start. She didn't become famous right from the start, but she was getting money from a record company, and she bought her own home. She didn't have to do a regular job. So she was spoiled, and you get the impression that it all came a bit too easily to her. And she behaved rather badly, actually. She was rather ungrateful. She soon became sulky and uncooperative and lazy. I mean, she very rarely performed, and she got a very bad reputation for cancelling concerts because she frankly couldn't be bothered. And she made more money than most of them. You know, a lot of these people didn't actually make much money in life. The money has come in death, and the money has, in most cases, come to the estate, and quite spectacularly so in the case of Jim Morrison, for instance. But in life, Amy actually made good money. She was quite wealthy when she died, and she was rather, I think, spoilt by that early success. And she said herself, you know, she would have been as happy, indeed she may have been much happier, working as a waitress in a pizza parlor. That was one of her fantasies, a sort of alternative life as a waitress in a pizza parlor. And she also very much wanted to get married and have kids and have a normal life. And to some extent, show business, fame, drugs, and all the rest of it, that ruled that out. And that was also true of Janis Joplin. And, of course, these are the two women in the group. And you do see this conflict between show business, a show business life, and a family life. And not, and they didn't achieve the family life.
Hmm. It's interesting, as you describe the final downward spiral, you touch on it briefly in the prologue of the book, and then, of course, we explore this in rather harrowing, disturbing detail at the end of the book. There was something about how Amy had kind of gone off of drugs and on drugs and off of alcohol and back to alcohol and so on, and never really appearing to seriously pursue the possibility of getting these addictions under control. What can you tell us about those efforts? I mean, were they efforts that she was never fully committed to, sort of imposed on her from others? Were they a sincere cry for help in any way?
Well, she did actually succeed in kicking the drug habit, which was quite an achievement. She was clean of drugs in the last couple of years of her life, but what she did was she replaced drugs with alcohol. And I think people underestimate how dangerous alcohol can be, and it seems surprising. I think a lot of people don't actually realize what Amy Winehouse died of. They assume maybe it was drug-related. But in fact, she drank herself to death. It was alcohol poisoning. And she drank prodigious amounts of alcohol. She had 3 empty bottles of vodka in her bedroom the night she died. That was what the police found. 5 times the drink drive limit of alcohol in her blood. She was regularly hospitalized because she was absolutely stinking drunk, passed out, unconscious on the floor. And like many people who abuse drugs, she went from one drug to the other. So she got rid of heroin and crack, cocaine, but she became a drunk. And so she was never clean in that sense. And you get the sense that she was just, you know, why was she doing this? The interesting question is, why was she getting drunk? Well, you know, it wasn't just because she liked the taste of vodka. She was getting drunk because she was desperately unhappy. You know, Samuel Johnson, the great English man of letters, said, who was also a bit of a drinker, said, "We drink to send ourselves away, to get away from ourselves." And that's why I think people generally drink, because they're unhappy. You don't drink to excess for fun. You drink to excess to forget yourself. Mm. And that's what she did, and she did it to the extent that she killed herself.
Mm. You give an absolutely stunning description, blow by blow, nearly moment by moment, of Amy Winehouse's final performance, an open-air concert in Belgrade, which was to have kicked off an ambitious tour. And in the long history of fiascos, this has to be one of the most horrendous ever delivered by or experienced by such a major artist. First of all, I'm just kind of curious. I mean, one would almost think you were there. I mean, you described this in such incredible detail.
Yeah.
And I wonder, how is it that we can know, in a sense, about every moment of this desperate and horrific last concert of Amy Winehouse?
Well, two ways, really. One is that one interviews the people who were there, the people who were on stage with her, the musicians, and of course they have very vivid memories of this terrible, disastrous concert where she was stinking drunk, incoherent, tearful, very upset, didn't want to do it, kind of had to do it because she was committed to financially to the tour. There were 20,000 people there to see her, but she was absolutely out of her head on drink, and it was a disaster. But also, of course, you know, these days everything is filmed and it's all on YouTube. And if you want to see how bad that it was, just put Amy Winehouse Belgrade into YouTube and you will see her on stage unable to remember the words to her own songs and breaking down in tears at the end of the whole thing. So, you know, YouTube is a great resource, and of course, and it's something you can rely upon because, you know, it's truthful. If people put their, if people film this thing with their cameras and put it on YouTube, you know, that's actually what happened. So that's a great resource, and it's a very sobering thing to watch, by the way. If you have 10 minutes, look up Amy Winehouse on YouTube in Belgrade, and then compare that to one of her better performances. She was also always, by the way, a very erratic performer. I mean, she didn't like performing. She suffered desperately from stage fright. She was very insecure, and the performance was an ordeal for her. And, of course, she was famous for these songs from the album Back to Black, which were songs about her unhappy marriage to Blake Fielder Civil. And, of course, when she performed, she had to sing those songs. So she had to sing about the worst times in her life. So that was an additional burden.
I realize now, as you described her and why you admire her, you consistently refer to her as a superb songwriter. And
yeah.
And in a sense, that was the heart of her talent, maybe more so than as a performer. And I think one of the things I found most touching as you described this disastrous final concert was the image of somebody named Ray standing off stage. I don't remember now who Ray was.
Her manager, yeah.
Oh, okay. But the person describing this says he just stood there off stage, his arms folded, the expression on his face, I'll never forget, helplessness. And I'm sure that that is something that also recurs again and again, that most of these artists surely have somebody in the mix that truly cares about them and even perhaps for self-serving reasons, does not want all of this to go down in flames. And yet at some point, a line is crossed and all you can do is look on with horror and helplessness. And that is the way this ends for Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, well, I think these are difficult people. I mean, Amy Winehouse was undoubtedly a very difficult person to deal with, very willful, prone to bad temper, to tantrums, throwing her weight around. Somebody says in the book that even God couldn't manage Amy Winehouse. I mean, she was just impossible to a degree. And the people involved in management, I don't mean her particularly, but generally, you know, they're in business. They're trying to make money. You know, the star is making money. They need the star to be on stage. They need the star to perform. They need the star to show up on time. And if the star is not in a fit state to perform, there's a kind of temptation to encourage them to perform anyway, because otherwise you've got to pay the money back. And in Belgrade, you know, they'd sold 20,000 tickets. So she turns up drunk. Now, what are you going to do? You kind of want her to go on stage, but perhaps in that particular instance, that was the wrong decision. So there's some of that going on, I think.
Yeah, that portion of the chapter ends with these words. The stage manager got Amy off as the crowd howled and booed, furious that they had paid to see such a fiasco. There were no encores. And, of course, to kind of bring me back to what I said at the very top of the interview, it's possible to bring up that footage on YouTube and or read about this and do so from sort of an emotional distance and sort of regard it the same way some people do when they drive slowly past the scene of a terrible car accident or walk a couple blocks so they can watch somebody else's house burning down. And on some deep level might feel some concern, but much more is just the emotion of just watching someone else's destruction or demise. And your book, in a sense, does not allow us to do that. Your book is about helping us understand who these people were and to experience their own suffering on a very different level.
Yeah, and I think also, of course, this is a universal experience. That we're talking about six people who we followed their lives in quite minute detail to in the last days and hours, and then death. Well, we're all going to die, and we all have to, we all can all empathize, really. How is our life going to end? You know, how are we going to wind up? You know, what mistakes have we made? What will our last days be like? And when you read about the last days and hours of these people, although they have exceptional circumstances and problems which perhaps we don't have, they're still ultimately facing up to death, and which we all have to do. And so that's something I found interesting as a writer, because you have to empathize with them, and that makes you reflect upon your own life and your own inevitable death. So it's a universal experience.
The book again is called 27, A History of the 27 Club Through the Lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. The book is published by Da Capo Press and includes extensive photographs which help to bring these stories further to life. And the author, Howard Soons. Howard Soons, I congratulate you on a very, very fine book. I'm really glad I read it, and I'm glad you and I could talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Greg.
Howard Soons is the author of this book again called 27, A History of the 27 Club. It was this particular Morning Show interview which sparked the idea for Carol Sabar and some of her colleagues at the Hedberg Library at Carthage College to create a collection of books within their collection that would highlight some of the books that have been featured on The Morning Show. And what came from that initial idea is now a special collection of about 150 different books that have been featured on The Morning Show. And later today, between 2 and 4 o'clock, there is a reception at the Carthage College Hedberg Library honoring this new collection, and with a short ceremony in which these books will be dedicated. The public is invited to attend. Refreshments will be served. A number of different WGTD personnel, including David Cole and David McGrath, are going to be on hand, and of course, I will be there as well. And we've invited a number of notable Morning Show guests to be there as well. But we're mostly interested in having WGTD listeners on hand for this special occasion, which is also in honor of my 30 years as part of the WGTD family. So once again, later today, from 2 until 4, with a special little presentation at 3 o'clock, a public reception at the Hedberg Library. I hope that I will see you there. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at the uncommon experience of parents with a young child whom they believe to be transgender. It is the author of a book called Raising Ryland. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you find The Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. I'm Gregory Berg. The time is 8:58. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. We are under a winter weather advisory here in southeastern Wisconsin until 2 o'clock this afternoon. There is the possibility of more light snow and some blowing snow today, and we could see total snowfall amounts of between 2 and 4 inches, depending on the specific location. We're watching especially for the possible generation of some lake effect snow over the next couple of hours. The winds could be a significant factor. Gusts are expected to be perhaps up to 30 miles per hour. Our high temperature today, right around 27 degrees. Again, a winter weather advisory in effect until 2 o'clock this afternoon. It will be cloudy, breezy, and cold tonight with an overnight low of 10 above. Tomorrow should be partly sunny with a high of 29 degrees. We could see a little more snow on Thursday under cloudy skies, a 50% chance of snowfall and a high of 30 degrees. By Friday, partly sunny skies and a high of 36. We should be warming up close to 40 on Saturday, close to 50 on Sunday and Monday. This is WGTD HD.